That's the great Taj Mahal with Done Changed My Way of Living. That's from his 1968 album, The Natural Blues. That's natural. See? Natural. Taj Mahal is a favorite of mine. And the last time I saw him, we were on the west side in Manhattan at a Chinese-Cuban joint. So it was great seeing him there. He lives in Hawaii. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. It is Friday, January the 16th, 2015. Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories. And as you know, the whole point here is to get things off your chest. Tell us what it is that you did in this past week to further probe the stories that we have discussed and other stories, things that may be on your mind that we haven't discussed but are worthy of further consideration or discussion and debate. I'm especially interested in hearing from people who haven't had yet been able to call in and have their say, but it is your time to bring to our attention those issues that you'd like to share with others and also to follow up on some of the discussions that we have had in this past week and perhaps even previously on Lead Stories. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. But I'd like you to make the effort to have a conversation so that we can really involve each other in the discussion that you want to have. And so it becomes more meaningful and more interactive. But let's go. 888-874-4888. It's your time on Lead Stories to free your mind. From Los Angeles. Was it? No, probably not. But it's Harvey on the air.
Hi, Yatrice. Harvey from Berkeley here. How wonderful, Yatrice.
Thank you.
I'm fine, and I'd like to indulge in a conversation with you. First of all, you know, we hear the term greenhouse gases, and it really sounds benign, but do you know what that means exactly? Because most people really don't have a good handle on it, and I didn't either until I sort of researched it. Do you understand what greenhouse gases are and what they do?
Well, these are the mostly carbon-based gases that are preventing the ozone, that are basically forming an occlusive shield around the ozone layer.
Well, it's actually more than that. The term greenhouse gases means that certain gases, like carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and even water vapor. What they do is they absorb and emit infrared radiation. Now, if you look at the electromagnetic spectrum, that's the light we see, one end is ultraviolet and the other end is infrared. And, you know, we have infrared lamps, heating lamps, that's infrared. So these gases that we're emitting into the atmosphere absorb these infrared radiation from the sun, and then they emit it, and they cause the atmosphere to warm up. It's actually, and what happens is that the warmer the atmosphere gets, the more evaporation of water off of our oceans and rivers and lakes, and the water vapor actually is the cause of bigger hurricanes, typhoons, tornadoes, and the melting of the polar caps. And so if you go to Google and put in the words runaway greenhouse effect, runaway greenhouse effect, that's what they think happened on Venus, where the atmosphere became overcarbonized. The temperature is about 600 degrees on the surface, and they feel that they had oceans that boiled away. So this is the direction we're heading in. At the same time, we have over 1 billion cars on the planet. We have worldwide trucks, buses, recreational vehicles, all the planes in the sky, all the construction machinery. Don't forget, this is worldwide. All the ships in the ocean, all the farm machinery, all the coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear power plants producing carbon, home heating, all the military use of fossil fuels. We are really gung-ho into changing our atmosphere, and it's the most dangerous thing that we're facing. And what we have to do is switch over immediately, as fast as possible. You know, it's been 2014 was the hottest year in the 135 years they've been recording the Earth's temperature, the atmospheric temperature. And so we have to switch away from this catastrophe and away from fossil fuels towards renewables. And one idea which will change terrestrial transportation is switching to the brushless electric hub motor wheel. And that is like a wheel that has a motor built into it, and you can make it scalable. Everything from roller skates up until large machinery can use those wheels. And we now have the battery technology and battery storage technology. Like, they're coming out with the GM Bolt, B-O-L-T, that's going to do 200 miles on a charge. And I say, where's the profit in a burnt-out planet? And it really is time to get star-powered. And I say, let's get solar, Utrecht.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the education on greenhouse gases.
Thank you, Utrecht. Bye-bye.
Thank you. From New York, Joel, how are you? I got your pieces. Very interesting.
Oh, thank you very much. How are you doing, Utrecht?
Good. Thank you.
I'm glad. By the way, I really enjoyed, as I always do, Kim Ives' presentation on your program.
Thank you.
It speaks to, for those who didn't listen to it, he is a correspondent and an editor at IUT Liberté, and it speaks to what I wanted to talk to today. I didn't get a chance to listen to your program that dealt with the media the other day, but it does speak to what I wanted to, because you never hear what's going on in AG. And as a matter of fact, most people don't even know about the ferment that's going on now, and they're not even aware of the Byzantine nature of Haitian politics and of American interference in Haiti's politics all these years. Again, I don't know what transpired on your program a few days ago, but and I apologize if I say anything that's redundant, but, I think a couple of events that have happened since 1945 that sort of mirror what's wrong with the mainstream media. And the first came in 1947, when the Truman administration started the Cold War by backing the Greek monarchy, who were pro-fascist and had worked with the fascists during the Second World War against the democratic insurgency. And the press knew it. The press knew about it, nonetheless, there was no contentious reporting whatsoever. The second came in 2001, when the second Bush administration declared its war on terror. And in each case, the media were forced into a choice they never should have been should have accepted or made. And this was between their professional standards and ethics on the one hand, however well, you know, or badly they live by them, and their so-called patriotic loyalty on the other. And in each case, they made the mistake of choosing, and twice they chose wrongly. And I have to tell you, growing up during the Cold War and coming into, you know, young adulthood during the Cold War decades were without question the single most shameful passage in the modern history of the American press, as far as I'm concerned. And everything that we see now really had its antecedents then. And that, this is why so little is ever said today about what newspapers and broadcasters did during that time. The record is very clear. It's perfectly available. All you have to do is take a look at the New York Times archives, and you'll see what I'm saying. But one finds no desire to examine it with the intent of learning from error. And I think, you know, I.F. Stone, the great renegade journalist of the 1960s, who wrote I.F. Stone's Weekly, which we all receive so we get the real news, and he did it through the mail because he was blacklisted in the 50s. He couldn't even write for The Nation magazine. He said that the best way for a journalist to be a good American is to be a good journalist. And, with, and you know, there's a lot of truth. And with exceptions, this thought was absent from the 1950s through the 1980s. Fear ruled, Utrecht, not less in the press than in film and elsewhere. One was a, quote, patriot first and only then a professional. And, in effect, a journalist following this dictum was neither, of course. Now, the Watergate period, you know, was one exception, I guess. But even there, their independence was somewhat circumscribed. Because if you remember, when the government finally, even when the press finally really went after Nixon, they never really talked about the illegal invasion of Cambodia. So it was never really about policy. It was always about his personal transgressions. But once that was over, we had a reconsolidation of power once Reagan assumed the presidency. So the American media had a very, very bad Cold War. And in my view, they've never recovered. Now, the second decisive moment was a kind of straight-ahead reprise of the first. And what you get when you refuse to look at the past and learn from it, and the years since speak for themselves. And this occurred, as I said, during the 2001. And what happened there was that the government, if you remember, convened every influential editor in the Capitol on a conference call and demanded that they make an agreement with the press, that the government make an agreement with the press, this was just a few days after 9/11, that the press not publish any stories that would go into details about the sources and methods of the government's intelligence programs. And the Times, if you remember, had already discovered the transgressions, which become, you know, obvious later on, and we learned that they had a massive surveillance program, and they sat on it for a year. I think you might remember that. And so I think in each case, you have a question of identity. What is the media's relationship to power? Is it in the old spirit of the Fourth Estate, you know, a freestanding pole of power, or is it an adjunct of political and military power and the power of prevailing ideology? And to me, that's really, I think, the crisis that we face today. It seems to me that the media today is a kind of ludicrously servile supplicant of power, and it fails to understand that in a pluralist society, you have to monitor power, and where necessary, like Tom Paine and others did, challenge power. And instead,
but I would ask you then, when, in your view, did the press ever, as an institution, uniformly perform the journalistic task that you thought, that you think it ought to have?
Well, you know, there are times when individual journalists have done that, and we all know
individuals, who they are. Yes, but institutionally, we could go all the way back to the various.
I think the only way to that I can really, I don't know, give a positive answer to that is to think about the two revolutions of the 18th century. For all of their shortcomings, and of course they had many, there were still elements within that revolution that were democratic. In other words, the power brokers of the revolution, certainly not in the American Revolution, because we all know that, you know, that the merchants in the North and the slave aristocracy were in cahoots. But Certainly the French Revolution had its radical elements, and the American Revolution did as well, the radical yeomanry, but they were suppressed. The reason why I bring this up is because that's where you saw an independent press. You saw an incredible amount of pamphleteering in the American and the French Revolution, and it was vibrant, and it challenged power. Think of...
I am also aware... specifically, let's say, of the black press or other non-mainstream publications, they were subjected to the harshest conditions and the strictest governmental reaction that you could see in the history of the United States.
Yeah.
In one case, even being threatened, to be shut down under the seditious, the Sedition Act, I should say, to say some cases being prevented from even acquiring newsprint, other cases being visited by the various arms of the government and warned directly that they should not express certain editorial opinions.
Yeah, well, that's part of the unfortunate history of free speech in this country, unfortunately. And we saw it again, by the way, right after the First World War, where all kinds of radical press organs were suppressed, and some of these people were even exported. So... You know, I wanted to get off, but I just wanted to mention some problems that just a couple of problems that exist today with the press, if I could, very quickly. And the first one is, I think we all see this, is the corruption of accuracy and honesty in exchange for access. That goes on all the time. All journalists today know all about the access game. And of course, all offers of bargain at this point should be withdrawn if they had any, you know, any conscience. The second one is the self-censorship that's transmitted throughout the system. And it seems to me that this has been prevalent and customary for so long as to be more pernicious than the overt variety, really. And the third one, I think, is the most is the one that concerns me the most, and that one concerns language. And what happens is if you assume the language of institutions and the language of sources and those covered, civilian casualties, for instance, become collateral damage. Real, you know, soldiers, ground forces become boots on the ground. The coup in Egypt last year is called the restoration of democracy, and so on infinitely. Journalists now tend to work in false language, and it makes the journalist a collaborator. And if I could offer one recommendation to your listeners, I would tell them, if they ever get a chance, to read Orwell's Politics in the English Language. We always, you know all about his two novels, 1984 and Animal Farm, but he's a great essayist. And that essay, written in the spring of 1946, really highlights what we're facing now. So I would say that those are the things that concern me about the media. The fact that it's lost its bearing, it doesn't understand its relationship to a democratic society, and its problems are endemic.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your contribution today.
Sure. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
From Dallas, the inimitable Sarah.
Greetings, you three.
Hello. How are you doing?
Well, I am doing as well as can be expected, you three. And greetings to the people. Yes, you three. Given the circumstances, I'm not going to tell that lie that I'm doing all that. Well, I'm healthy. Let's be grateful for the small mercies that we do have. I am healthy and no major complications. And greetings to your PRN listening audience, you three. This has been a very interesting start of the new year, to put it mildly.
But, thank you.
Yes, ma'am. But to cover your situation, your situation on Haiti, I didn't get a chance to listen to that program on yesterday, so I will go back into the archives and I will listen to it to get caught up on this. But it kind of ties in with everything that's been going on with France becoming the new hub of all of this. You know, everything has kind of descended onto Paris and everything else that's going on, that their angst and whatever it is that they're going through, that everyone is trying to feel their pain. But what I find very disingenuous with this whole charade that's been put on, this theatrics that's been done for public consumption, is this notion of these leaders who were front and center and leading this unity peace march. You see, this is so oxymoronic, and this is why I always like to tell people that we have to be very careful of the English language that, you know, we've all went through lives with nutrients where we have all of these different words that says one thing and different spelling, but, you know, sound the same. And we've got to be very cognizant and ask people to please give us definitions when they say things, because I said black people in particular, we tend to fall for face value for what people say. Because when you say peace, we need to ask you to spell that peace. When you say pray, I need to know which one of the pray you're speaking about. Same thing goes with debt. We need to know which one of it you're speaking of, because we could be thinking about credit and they're thinking about physical debt. So that is where we always get confused, because we don't ask. We have a meaning in our head or a definition in our head, and the people that you're speaking to, they're coming from a totally different script of what it is that you might be conceiving in your head as to what it is that they're speaking of. Now, these people, these leaders in Paris, these are all the gross violators of human rights as well as freedom of speech, and they were in front and center. Netanyahu, for instance, front and center. Sarkozy, Hollande, and Angela Merkel, and all of these people who are out there. And these are the people who have issues in their country. Same thing goes with the Netherlands and the Dutch people. To me, when they're saying freedom of speech means to say only if you're classified as being Europeans, namely specifically Jewish Europeans, then you can say you have the right, you have a bit more edge in saying what you want to say. Because the minute you say something that is critical to Israel or to the Jewish people, then they want to label you as being an anti-Semite. They go and they pull out that word, that ace in the hole, to shut you down, to get you from forming critical critique of them and their policy. This is not being anti-Semite if you want to say it. It's the same thing we go through over here, Eutresa says. When we say something to of a nature that is offensive to Europeans, one of the first things they want to do is label you as being a racist when you are stating facts. And that's the same thing that has happened here in Paris, where they have muzzled everyone. They have put a muzzle on everyone. And if you say something that is critical to Israel, then all of a sudden you are labeled an anti-Semite, you are labeled anti-Jewish. They start with the Jewish bashing, but they're not allowing you to speak and say what it is. To me, this whole incident with Paris and this bombing, who benefited the most? Because if you're trying to say it's Arab terrorists, then these Arab terrorists must be working in league with the Jewish people, because the Jewish people always end up coming out as the ones benefiting the most with all of these terrorism things. It's not the Arab people. So it tells me that it can't be these Arabs and these Muslim terrorists that they are saying about that's doing it, that it's something else nefarious that's going on under the surface, because it always comes back into their camp and always set them up as being the victim, the Jewish people as being the victim rather than the victimizers. What was done this past summer in the Gaza, where Netanyahu slaughtered those people, then he had the nerve to get into the Grand Mosque and made that speech about their right to defend themselves. You have a right to defend yourself. Everybody have a right to defend themselves, including the Palestinian people. But these people, they had no military might within which to defend themselves. You put them into a bowl, basically, and you was like shooting fish in a barrel. You had an advantage where you slaughtered innocent people. You attacked schools. You attacked hospitals, and you slaughtered people. And you had the nerve to be front and center to lead a peace rally. That was so disgraceful and so shameful. And all of this propaganda bought and paid for corporate media, they ran it, and they kept playing it over and over again and kept saying that the president was not there. The president don't need to be there because he's another war criminal. You know, he sent Eric Holder there in his stead, but he's a war criminal. He's using drones to kill innocent people, and these other people are using ground forces, invading troops to go in there and kill people. So they're all war criminals standing up out there, and they're talking about these 17 people who was alleged to have been killed in these mass attacks on the newspaper office. You know, this is what you call you treat as you've been laying it out to us with these people and the media, and how, you know, and I always go back to Malcolm X and what he's always said about the media and how they can be manipulated and used against the people to get you thinking and going in different directions. And we can see it unfolding before us, where this media have become very complicit with the government and push the government's agenda. And they're the ones who lay out the policy plainly for everyone else, the gullible and naive public, to swallow and to take a hold and to follow along with, to go against our best interest. This is what the media has been turned into doing.
Well, I don't disagree with anything you said so far. I'm wondering, though, what from your point of view is an appropriate reaction or solution?
Well, the appropriate reaction and solution would be, Utrice, is that you have got to get to the root cause of the problems. If people are disgruntled in Paris and all around the globe as to what Israel is doing, Israel needs to be stopped, looked at as being a favored child. They need to stop being, because the things that they have done, as I've repeatedly said, when you have bad children that you allow to spoil and get out of hand, they will eventually embarrass you in public in such a way, and now you can't do nothing about, you can't save your face anymore. And Israel, they've taken off the gloves, and they've shown us that they don't care, that they will do whatever it is that they want. The Palestinians want a seat on the Security Council. No, you can't have that. The United States go along with them. If the people in Paris and Germany, they said okay, and Norway and all these other countries saying no, no, y'all need to stop. What happened? They get terrorism strikes, because you see, with Norway, with what Norway wanted to do when Norway wanted to pull out of the situation with the bombing in Libya, Norway ended up getting they end up getting it on their shores. Sweden, the same thing is going on in Sweden. Germany, all over Europe, the same thing is doing. And they're trying to put the blames as these Muslims, these terrible Arab people, and we need to clamp down on them. And perhaps they're not really, French people, or they're really not German people, because, you know, they got these funny names and they believe in a different religious aspect. You know, they're not Judo-Christians. You know, they're Muslims and their prophet is different. You know, all of this nonsense that they come up with as an excuse. And I keep telling people, it does not matter how long you might stay in a country. You see in Europe, how these Europeans, you could be there for four or five generations, and they still look at you as an outsider, that you are not one of them. You could speak the most perfect diction in French, German, whatever. You are not one of us. You're one of them. And it's the same thing that we need to do with them, because the same thing we need to do with them on the African continent, because to me, if you're not indigenous African, I don't consider you to be African. I don't care how long you might be in South Africa. You just happen to be an invader that happened to overstay your time there, and now you're calling yourself a South African, because you're not one of us. Because I cannot go to China, Utrice, make a child in China, and then say my child is Chinese. They're not going to be accepted.
Well, you put a lot on the plate here. And no surprise in that department for us to consider. Thank you so much for your call
You're
today.
You're welcome, Utrice. Have a good weekend.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much, Sarah. From New York, Ali, you're on the air.
Hi, Utrice, and just wanted to say hello to every member of your audience there, and I just wanted to send my hello from here, from New York City. And yesterday, in that cold weather, we were out there fighting again for Black Lives Matter again.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I actually called for something else that I want you to give me some clarification, because I just listened to your conversation with Margie on Wednesday, and I just wanted to give you and run down on my idea of her idea and what you said on the air on that day. But I just wanted to tell everyone that we were out here yesterday. We started around 8:30 in the morning in Staten Island, then took the ferry and came into Manhattan, and you had to see how the cops, about more than 40 cops, following us on the ferry. Then we got into the subway. They were in another car and following us. But I just wanted to say that it's so many organizations that I don't think the government going to be able to strike down what is going on right now with the movement, because if you compare this movement with the Occupy, they have pockets in different cities. This is so many organizations that are involved with this movement that I don't know. They're very, very extremely afraid of what is going on the street right now.
Tell us about Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter, as everybody knows, is like black and brown lives that don't matter in this country. It's not only to the cops that they have been killing us, but it's about the system. This system, in the beginning, or what you call the beginning of this country, and I'm just saying the beginning of the country, when this European came here, they always had marginalized the native that they were in this land, and also the people that they brought into this land to work free, because that's one thing that these white Caucasian people out on the street, they always call on us. When they see them protesting, always go and get a job. But I guess they don't remember how black African American, they work free in this nation, how they build this nation. And this is, we have been out there, especially since the killing of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. One, because he had his hands off Michael Brown, and because Eric Garner was suffocated right on the floor, and they killed him right in front of our eyes. And these cops, they have gotten away with it. I mean, the system, they are part of the 99%, but when it comes to judge them with the law, they're using the 1%. The law that is applied to the 1% of the population. And that is why they think that they don't belong into the 99%. That's one thing that I have to say. And here in New York, we have been protesting. We're going to be out there on the 19th on Monday. And one of the things that the police department is doing is getting to our Facebook page, and they're getting all the information of the Facebook page. As a matter of fact, one of the group that I belong to, called OccuRevolt, part of Occupy Wall Street, was mentioned on TV, and we couldn't even believe it that these people, they go into our homepage to get all this information from our group. But you know, that's another story, but I do wanted to say something about your conversation with Margit on Wednesday.
Yes, it's my aunt, I believe.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I just wanted to say about Wednesday when you had a conversation with her that you don't believe, for me, you want people to give facts and don't talk about conspiracy theory in here every time. And what I gather for now, I want you to explain to me, when I start listening to your program, I believe it was last year, I start listening to your program because WBI was having problem, and I easily listened to Gary Noel, and I just left the program, and you came on, and I started listening to you. And on one of those days that I think I made my first phone call, you were talking about Edward Snowden, and you thought, and I think you're still thinking, that he's an agent, okay? So I wanted to know the facts that you have that you could prove that he's an agent of the of the NSA, because one of the things that Margie was talking about is all the information that she had gathered, and I gathered that you also had gathered information to prove to us that he's an agent. And I wanted to know what is the difference for what she was telling you about what happened in France, and why you're telling us that Edward Snowden is an agent of the NSA or of the CIA. So what is the difference between the two of us, the two subjects? Because I'm going to tell you one thing. One thing that I don't believe, and this is the same thing with 9/11, is that here in New York City, they found the passport of one of the terrorists on the plane. And then in France, in Paris, they found the ID in the card, in the supposedly card that these people use, and we never saw. And that attack reminds me pretty much of what the Israeli did to the Marmar, I believe I had the wrong name, of the boat that was trying to reach Palestine. And that attack is almost similar. It's almost professional. Who attacked, because they went on the day that these people were in the room having a meeting at the same time, and that's how they attacked them. These two individuals went, and they had all the information, and then they had two policemen, and their policemen, they weren't able to do anything, and they were supposed to be protecting these people in that office. So I just wanted to know the difference between when you were talking about Edward Snowden and what Margie was trying, because she actually gave you two names of the people that I read. She gave you Paul Craig Roberts, And mm-hmm. also she gave you what she had heard on Democracy Now. And another mm-hmm. person that I will give you, another name, is Webster Tarpley, that I have mentioned to you, that you and Webster Tarpley, the only two people that I have heard that they have said that Edward Snowden, he thought, you thought that he was an agent, and he thought that he was an agent. And I'm just leaving it to you because I'm a little bit confused about the two conversations.
Okay. Well, a couple of things. Paul Craig Roberts, who, as you may recall, was a guest on this program talking about the pitfalls of Obamacare, the hidden pitfalls of Obamacare. And in that regard, he was quite knowledgeable and was able to talk from an authoritative point of view. So I have respect for him. And I read the piece that he wrote about it, about the attacks in Paris. And I also said on Facebook, responding to some people, that he was very careful to point out that what he was presenting were what he considered to be plausible scenarios. He never said that these are facts. Plausible scenarios. But we were presented with another opinion that was presented as fact. Now, and we have to be careful about that. It is very important to gather as much information from as many different sources as possible. That's great. But we also have to concede that, A, we don't know everything. And even some of the experts who are writing about it and discussing it, there's a limit to what they can present as facts of the specific situation. Now, I discussed Edward Snowden on two counts. One, suspicion about his role. And number two, the evident racism of Edward Snowden and the extraordinary sense of entitlement. It was just so blatant, it was completely unavoidable. I did say that his methods suggested or would lead me to believe that we have to be very careful about this guy. Everything about him and the way he had operated, and I read his actual statements on Ars Technica, emails, his postings on Ars Technica. That's him himself, and that's the basis on which I talked about his what seemed to me to be blatantly racist points of view. None other than Ed Snowden himself said that he was trained by the CIA. None other than Snowden himself. So I would imagine that he knows whether he was actually trained as a spy, and he said it. So I think I was kind of dead on there.
Yes, but do you understand what I'm saying? He said it, but he hasn't been proven. No.
If he himself said it, and initially he had denied it, when people were saying, well, we have to be very suspicious, he came forward months later and said, well, yes, I was trained as a spy. And he did say, I pointed out so many ways along the way, you know, how he contradicted himself. You may recall that there was a point where he said everything that he had written, I said it. Was I the only person in the country to hear Ed Snowden actually admit that the government was writing, the stories that were published with the knowledge and approval of the government? He said it. We did a program on that. I played the tape twice from his own mouth. So, I mean, I can't get any more authentic corroboration than from the mouth of Ed Snowden. His writings are his writings. This was not some intermediary interpreting his postings. These were his postings. I read them verbatim on the air, on this program. So this was not conjecture. This was not opinion. These, I would think, are as close to fact as you could get.
Yeah, but it's still, to me, personally, I don't think that the point, yes, and I agree with you in some of the points that you gave about him, and I'm still very suspicious about him. I'm still, because I at that time when you were talking about him, I have heard that information before, which it was from Webster Tapley. He explained it very well. And then I heard you, because that's when I started listening to your show. But in the case of Margit, I'm just saying, maybe it's not completely a conspiracy theory, because we don't know all the facts about exactly. But I'm going to tell you one thing, and one thing I just don't believe, that a plane who's crashed in the tower, you're going to find just one passport, and then you're going to find that, especially in Paris, finding just that ID in the car, there is a lot of indication that attack was very professional. Just to the
I agree. I am not disagreeing with anything that you're saying. Here's a point I'm trying to make. Uh-huh. If we're discussing all of the plausible scenarios, that is to say, we don't have facts, but just as you said, there are some things that are just not smelling right. Okay, well, let's have that kind of conversation about the things that are just not smelling right about this case. But we can't cross the line and say that because it's not smelling right, it just isn't the fact. I mean, it is the fact. No, we can't do that. Because now what you're doing is you're transforming a feeling, intuition, an idea into a fact. And we don't have any way of corroborating what we're saying. I corroborated everything I said. I didn't just say, well, I just think Snowden is this, and I think Snowden. I got it. I read it on the air. I said, and I directed people, go to this site, Ars Technica, that posted his actual postings, and you will see what he said. Now, I played the tape. This is not anybody but Ed Snowden talking himself. And I was alarmed at the fact that I heard him say something that nobody had covered, that he actually admitted that the stories that were being published with the permission and the review of the government and the consent of the media. This is alarming for a person who is saying how he's anti-government and he's railing against the government and whatnot. He's actually saying, we're cooperating with them. So you see, this is what I mean. I'm a journalist. I like the idea of corroborating what I say or present as fact. And I would like everybody else to kind of do that. But if you have an intuition, say it's an intuition. If you have a feeling, say it's a feeling. In other words, you're presenting an opinion as opposed to a fact. That was my problem with it.
Okay.
And there was another problem with it, and I might as well go whole hog on the subject since this opportunity presents itself. By the time that subject came up, we were well on our way with respect to the stated purpose of our discussion, which was not about Al-Qaeda. It was about the magazine and its racism. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the magazine had a glaring contradiction of repeating and emulating the same racist, imperialist, colonialist mindset that one would have expected that as a so-called radical or leftist publication, it would have parted ways with, but it didn't. That was the conversation. Now, the caller decided that it probably was not of interest or probably not of as interest as pertinent a discussion, and just decided to take the discussion someplace else where she wanted to go. Apart from the fact that it was very rude to do that, it was a deliberate disruption simply to say, well, I have particular knowledge of something that people need to know. But it was not our discussion. So it actually was a kind of rude disruption of a conversation that had begun on the program, and despite very gentle nudging to, you know, could you come as close as possible to the subject that is already in play, rather than divert us into something else where you want to go, and even gentle, subtle hints were not heeded. So that's where we were with that discussion.
Okay. Thank you for your explanation.
Thank you for asking me the question. Thanks a lot, Ali, for your call. From New York, Leah, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I just wanted to thank you publicly for hosting our rally and legal defense fund on behalf of the Friends of Walton Maddox last Saturday. And
it was
I also
a pleasure,
wanted to...
and it was a duty. Thank you.
Yes. You're quite welcome. And I also wanted to mention, on behalf of Sarah, that I mentioned her name to the audience, and there was a tumultuous response. So, Sarah, if you ever come to New York, you're a celebrity here.
She is indeed, yes.
Yes. I wanted to say that with regard to Friends of Walton Maddox, we have a campaign going to demonstrate that Black Lives Matter, and it's a two-prong effect. It's in conjunction with the effort to reinstate Walton Maddox, and as we know, or we may not know, Walton Maddox will be representing Ramsey Orta, the videographer in the Eric Garner case, next Thursday, January 22nd, in Staten Island Supreme Court. So we would like for all who can attend that at 9 o'clock to appear. However, with regard to the Black Lives Matter campaign, we're asking, you know, since Walton Maddox has no income, he has had no income for 25 years, and he still must pay his attorney fees, and they amount to $2,150. We're asking everyone in the PRN and way past community to contribute just $1. I think that's something that's doable by virtually anyone, in the form of a money order. And I'm going to give kind of a lot of information, but I'll give a phone number where you can get more information on this. The money order for $1 would be made out to the Office of Court Administration. That's the organization that collects the attorney fees, and that would help Attorney Maddox. With regard to the Black Lives Matter, in the from section on the money order, you would put your name and the name of a black person who died as a result of a racially motivated situation. For instance, if your name is Mary Smith, then you might put Mary Smith for Emmett Till. And it would be mailed to Friends of Walton Maddox, Post Office Box 35, Bronx, New York, 10471. And for I know that's a lot of information. If anybody missed it, you can call 917-947-8994 to get specific instructions. And now my mind is free because I've said my piece.
Well, thank you very much, Leah, for your call.
Yes, thank you very much.
Leah's referring to last Saturday. I was very privileged to be part of a fundraiser for Walton Maddox. I believe strongly that the community has to stand up and surround this man, show support in a very real way, because his entire history has been fighting the system pro bono, no charge, for in almost all of the cases where there was a retainer, he explained to me, wherever there was a retainer, and they were few, the retainers were to cover all kinds of related costs, and no further charges ever were applied in the one or two cases in which a retainer was given. But for the most part, and in the more than 30 years that I've known Alton Maddox litigating these cases, he's never charged a fee and has won significant victories that have set legal precedents in the entire United States. So what the court has done, what the state legislature has done under with the conspiracy of complicity by the governor and the state attorney general and so forth, is just so patently illegal. And to my mind, this particular case deserves close scrutiny, and from the community's point of view, a decided effort to support his battle with the system. So I was very pleased to be there in the company of community folk on Saturday. So I urge you to support this effort as well. It's only a dollar, but it's a very important dollar. Thank you so much. DX, you have the privilege of bringing up the rear today from Los Angeles.
Okay. How are you today, Eugene?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for asking. I hope everyone out there has a lovely weekend. Go out and do something fun. And I'd just like to say that I have thoroughly enjoyed all the people who called in today and the information that was given. I just wanted to point out a couple of things that happened in the last couple of weeks, because I think we get mired down in so many things happening all the time, and we forget to celebrate our small victories that do occur. And there were two of them in the last couple of weeks. First one, and I'll be brief because I know the show is coming to an end, but the first one, cops were indicted in Albuquerque. And if people are not familiar with this incident that happened last year in March, a homeless man named James Boyd was executed, murdered in the rural areas of Albuquerque. He was a homeless man who traveled around just camping at different places, and all he had was a backpack and a few survival tools, maybe a knife and things like that. So they go out to confront him. And the video's online. People can look it up. His name is James Boyd. Basically, first they shoot a shock light similar to a grenade, shock grenade, and it disoriented him. Then he started to turn around and walk away. Now, keep in mind, this is in a rural area. He's not hurting anybody. He's not encroaching on anybody's property. He's out in the desert part. So then after that, he turns around and they end up shooting him about five times in the back. He goes down, and as he's laying there, face down, he's still moving a little bit. He's still alive. They have the nerve to shoot him with about three or four bean bags and then sick the dogs on him. So he dies right there on camera. Within 2 minutes, he's dead. So pretty disturbing video. So anyway, back to the indictment. What happened in the last week or so is that the grand jury did decide to indict these officers that did this. So that's one victory we have. I don't know if they're going to be convicted, but at least that's a start. They did indict, so they will be going to trial for murder one. So that's good. So the second one is this past Friday, a police chief in Pittsburgh named Cameron McLay, he actually showed up at a demonstration and had the quote-unquote nerve to have a sign that says, "I am committed to fighting racism in my workplace." Now, I say he had the nerve because he got some backlash for even just carrying a sign. I think it's good that police chiefs like this one are willing to step out and do something like this. I think it's very good, and we need to celebrate him. And any support and emails and messages we can send him would be good. He got basically excoriated by the union chief, the police union head in Pittsburgh, who said, among other things, that he it was a transgression, and him being photographed with the sign was basically a disrespect to police and calling everybody racist. And another officer actually sent this police chief an email saying that, oh, you're calling us all racist, so, you know, we don't like you anymore, basically. So I think it's very telling that they, when somebody says a blanket statement, I'm going to fight racism in my department, they all stand up and say, oh, wait a minute, you're calling us racist. He never called anybody racist. So that's good that he stood up for that. So that's, I wanted to mention those two things. And people can also look up that story online.
Thank you. And you're right. Those are two very interesting departures from what we have come to regard as the norm, with police officers who are being exonerated even before the system takes action.
Right.
So thank you for bringing that, and you made a strong point there. We do have to recognize when things are proceeding accordingly. Thank you so much.
Right, and the last thing I want to say is that people don't be discouraged that much. We are going to win this fight. We just all have to be mobilized, and I will be going out to a couple of rallies this weekend, tomorrow, for Millions March and for Black Lives Matter here in L.A. So let's just keep at it, and let's not get discouraged, okay?
Thank you so much for your call. And
okay,
that brings us to the end of our program today. Excellent, excellent contributions today. And I thank you for always making the strong effort to operate and to exchange your views at a particular level. And it is consistently high. So you do a great honor to the program, to fellow listeners, and obviously to yourselves by keeping the standards high. Thank you so much for that. And, of course, as usual, I thank you also for the pleasure and privilege of your company. On Monday, we will return to each other, hopefully relatively unscathed over the weekend. Stay tuned. Keep it right here. Richard Martin is up next with Wake Up Call. You can always reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Again, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.